Mr. Cheeseman, real one. When and where were you born, Mr. Cheeseman?
Well, I was born on the 27th of October 1917. That's just around about the time that the Russian Revolution began or ended. And I think there's some significance in that, you know. Anyway, I was born then, and in a mining village called Southmoor, just south of West Stanley, that's northwest Durham. Now, both my parents, by the way, were farming stock. But when my brother was born 4 years before this, my father had to pack in farming because his wages wasn't good enough when he went into the mines. He would, of course, realise that the First World War was in full swing at the time.
Did he serve in the First World War?
No. The reason being that he, as a boy, he had his left eye whipped out with a whip, and he wasn't fit enough. Anyway, he went into the mines to get more money, and that's how we became a sort of mining family in the mining community. And like all mining communities, it was self-contained. For instance, I can remember as a lad going and watching the local butcher slaughter on a Tuesday. I couldn't do that today, but anyway. Or if one took me, I'll go and have a look through the window at the cobbler making boots, or have a look through a shop, another shop window at the watchmaker repairing. You see what I'm getting at? It was a living community and self-contained. And of course, even our... Remember, this is before the radio. And so our time signal was, of course, the buzzer of the pit, which, of course, was never Greenwich Mean Time, but it was certainly Southmoor time, and that's how we went with it. As a matter of fact, if I may, I'd like to tell you a joke about that. Many years afterwards, I recall this, and that is that when the wireless did come in, 1922, I think it was, when the wireless did come in, this chap bought himself a wireless. And at that time, of course, Big Ben would strike at 12 o'clock. Well, he had, it was a Christmas set, and of course he had earphones, or cans, as they called them, earphones. And, quiet, everyone, listen, because the clock's coming. And he got to, and there was Big Ben, striking 12 o'clock. He brings out his whacking great watch, and he looks at it and he says, "You know, there's a damn good clock to put down in London." He says, "It hasn't lost not a minute since yesterday. I checked that." He says, "But I wonder why they keep it 10 minutes fast." Anyway, I'm digressing, aren't I?
Was it a very supportive community, mining community?
Absolutely, yes. The woman along at the end of our street was the district nurse. No, we did have a district nurse, by the way, but she was the one that we all went to. Oh, by the way, as well, the talk about the National Health. We had a National Health then. A miner's pay, he would get his pay note on a Wednesday, and because if he was in the wrong shift, he could never go for his pay on a Friday, his wife would do it. But anyway, this pay note was a long, long thing. On the top was what he'd, his gross pay, then the off-takes, and on this off-takes was not only the sort of the, if he was the amount of gunpowder he'd had to buy, or what have you, but there was also all the doctors' names in the area, four or five of them. There was also the district nurse, there was also the ambulance, which incidentally I can just remember was horse-drawn at the time, but anyway, there was the ambulance, the cottage hospital, and the Royal Victoria Hospital in Newcastle. Now, if you paid a penny to your doctor, a penny to the district nurse, a penny to the ambulance, a penny to the cottage hospital and the Royal Victoria Hospital in Newcastle, you were fully covered. Now, how was that for you? You know, what's that? That's 5 minutes.
Did your father find it difficult, you say he'd been a farmer, going into the mine situation? Miners themselves like to think they were almost a generation, you were born and bred to it.
Well, his parents died when he was 12, so I never had any paternal grandparents at all. And that's how he used to die, I suppose, fooling about with, on the back of a truck. And the driver whipped back him and lost his eye. Kept him on the arm. Anyway. The point was that he, whilst he was an ordinary data hander, a farm labourer, he was very, very skilled. He could shear sheep, he could milk, he could plough, he could sow. In fact, he was himself a farmer, as it were. And how did he get on when he went into the pit? Dreadful, dreadful. My mother told me the story. When he first went into the pit, of course, he was a devil then. And she told me that, can you imagine this? She told me that for umpteen shifts, he worked in 3 foot to the roof,
seams.
3 foot seam, with 2 foot of water. It bottles the imagination, doesn't it? Well, anyway. But he didn't stay long at that. His heart was, after all, a farmer's heart. And the only other thing that he'd get near enough as a miner was a horse keeper. And he became a mine horse keeper right through his life. And incidentally, I can remember this. You'll appreciate the fact that those days were no pretend baths, what I would tell you. And the bath was put on the floor in front of the fire. And so my brother and I would see him there, and he'd wash himself. One day he came home from work, he was on morning shift at 2 o'clock. He came home from work, he could hardly walk. He was old, and when he stripped off, a huge bruise on his right chest, dreadful. A horse had kicked him, because he had to train off. The poor frightened ponies would be taken down the business, and he had to train them. Now, you'll appreciate this, by the way, that that when you are a putter with a pony down the pit, i.e. you're the man that is in charge of the horse, which is trained, you walk behind the tubs of coal and the horse. In case you're going down hit an incline, if the horse stumbles and you're in front, you get run over with the coal tubs. You walk behind, but not if you're training a horse, and this is what my father had to walk in front. So it was quite a dangerous job as well. But anyway, dreadful, you know. Now, he went to work next day, so I managed it and so on like that, and he eventually got okay, and we just forgot all about it. Until my mother wrote this to a letter to me when I was in the army, by the way. 1937 or something like that, my father retired and he got Pittman's dust disease, of course, because the dust off the horses, you know, when he's groomed them. But he had bronchitis, terrible. Anyway, he'd be x-rayed. First time he'd been to hospital, whatever. And when the doctor was examining the pop of the x-rays, he said, "Mr. Cheeseman, when or where and how did you get 3 broken ribs on the right hand side?" He just took that. And a beautiful, very, very, well, he wouldn't say a voodoo goose, very much my father.
The wage he was getting, was it?
6 and 6.8 a shift.
And was that a good wage for the time?
No, it was, and it was. 6 and 6.8 a shift for 7 shifts a week. 7 shifts a week. Got a horse, and I never remember my father having a day off, except during the 1926 strike, of course. But, you see, horses had to be fed every day. That's Christmas Day, Boxing Day, every day. He never had a time off. And so that regular six and sixpence halfpenny a shift for 7 days a week was a damn good wage. Because in those, certainly during the Depression, the latter part of the 20s, early part of the 30s, Pitts were only working 1, 2, and 3 days a week. So he would only be getting 1, 2, or 3 times 6 or 6 months. Why are they not having that mentioned? A dismal hand's wage, the labourer in a man down the pit in those days was 6 and 6 pence a shift for a man. He got the heavy because he was a skilled man, horsekeeper. It makes you laugh, doesn't it? Anyway, that was the wage. And yes, we did live very, very well. My mother did a lot of dressmaking. Incidentally, my father was Church of England, and until he was 12 years old when his parents died, he was a chorister. He was born at Whittonstall, just over, you know, in the Northumberland there. My mother was Methodist, absolutely primitive Methodist. Now, he was never, I suppose because he didn't have parents to guide him, he was never a religious chap, was my father, but he did say that, look, I'm reading from my mother, I have my sons christened in the Church of England, and after that, you can look after them. So, it so happens that I was christened in the Church of England. I spent all my formative years in the primitive Methodist, suffering an hour and a half sermons or whatever, and that was it, you know. Now, when I met my wife, Barbara, she was Church of England, and of course all the padres in the army were Church of England, as ecumenical. I was OD by the other denomination during the peacetime. And I got quite friendly with the padre in my unit, and anyway, so I met Barbara. She was Church of England, and you know, I forget how it came about, and we got married during the war. I'll tell you about that later. But as regards this marriage business, it so happened that we had to go to Church of England to get married. And I happened to mention this to the family. He says, you know, you ought to become Church of England. So, I'm jumping the gun here, never mind, to keep the story going. I went to confirmation classes when we went out to the Middle East on board the Stirling Castle, beautiful boat, and I was confirmed in Alexandria in Egypt by a New Zealand bishop. So how about that? A League of Nations.
Whilst we're on the subject, we may as well deal with it now. Without going into any great detail, how important was your religion to you in the tests in the army that were to come?
Very important, very important. I was, after all, I was a divine appointment, but I think the best thing I can put it succinctly is what my great-grandfather used to say. He said, I'm not altogether in favour of all this focus and going to church and what have you said, but you know, the Ten Commandments are not a bad set of rules to work to, he said. So that's me. And that's me.
You mentioned the fact that you had brothers. How many were in the family?
There's only two. My brother, he's now dead, by the way, Harold. Now, he, as usual, he was different to me as chalk and cheese. He was religious. In fact, up at the Snubs, that's just north of Shotley Bridge, he was the organist there for about 46 years. You know, so he was well into that sort of thing.
Was he older brother?
Yes, 4 years older than me.
You mentioned the fact that your mother did dress work, and obviously she ran the house. Mm. What qualities did your mother pass on to you?
Perseverance, I think, and actually, if the job's worth doing, then it's worth doing well, that sort of thing, you know. She was actually, she was the master as well as the mistress of the house. Not unusual in those days, after all, the poor old man, considering, you know, the amount of work he had to do, he was in coal, he was only a wage getter. The Chancellor of Exchequer and all that sort of thing, that was the woman that was his wife. I can tell you a story about that, and I can remember this, because well, it never happened now, most of course, but and that is that the woman of the manual house, she'd make the meal. And she'd put the meal on the table. No one was allowed to touch that meal until the miner himself had had his fill. Then what he left, the family could have. Now that seems terrible, but look at it this way. If he didn't eat to gain energy, and in fact, if he didn't keep his health, and he went ill and couldn't go to work, nobody ate. So you see, there was a solution to that as well.
What was the family discipline like within the home?
It was very strict, which I used to jib against. I've jibbed against authority all my life, and now after being in the army 11 years as well. But I know in my wisdom years, my later years, that you do need a set of rules, and otherwise an organisation becomes a mob. And I found that the discipline in the army, in the tank corps, the Royal Tank Corps, wasn't all that irksome. And in fact, I took it in my stride. Just occasionally that I, in fact, on one occasion, I told no less a personage than the RSM that he was a bloody bastard. Guess what landed with me? Sorry about that.
We'll come back, yeah. The discipline in the home was...
The founder of which was Mr. Henley, the inventor of winding billy, popping billy. But it was a huge would have been the Sunday Claus would have drawn out and said, so you get to, and that was, you know, the routine.
And your mother presided over all this.
She was king, queen, boss, yes, the whole lot. My father was the wage earner, the finance, the supplier of them. If ever we hurt ourselves, it was the mum who did. He would be there if we wanted to do that. He was always in the background, always there. Very important. If he wasn't working. If we had been punished, it was the mother. I have never heard my father raise his voice towards me, to anyone, I think.
Did he have an allotment or a large garden?
No. It seems to be a known thing that all farmers don't like gardening. Well, you know, my wife's father, he was a deputy at the same coal company, another colliery, he was a deputy. And he had two gardens, and all his life. And he had horses, boats, ducks, what have you. Know. But that was quite normal, really, for the normal type of mining family.
Did your father drink?
The odd half. As I say, my mother was sick at the time, and therefore she had nothing to do with strong drink, as it were, you know. And my father didn't worry. I know he'd been occasionally with friends. No, his friends were not miners, they were the old farmers. And indeed, I remember when possible on a Saturday we'd go and visit various farms that he knew and it was this particular farm where he lodged, of course, for many, many years before he got married. His friends used to congregate there in the farm kitchen. One called Matthew. Another called Mark, my father's name was Luke, and it was a John. So he seemed worth feeling this way, the other one. But I also remember that, and of course, we walked everywhere in those years.
There tended to be lots of pubs in mining areas, did they not?
Yes. In fact, I think this is pretty well typical of all mining shopping centres, as it were, if I can use them like that. It appears, I'm not, as you know, not a native of Langley Moor, but it appears that Langley Moor used to be a sort of mining shopping area, market village, as it were. Stanley was just one. And it was always said of Stanley that you start at the top house, the first pub you came to after passing the pit, of course, you have a half a nut, or a jug of beer, no, a jug is a quarter of a pint, but a jug of beer with half of a pint. Start with a half a pint in there, and you go into each pub and have half a pint there, and you were drunk before you got to the bottom of Stanley Street. I think that was typical of any mining community.
You mentioned the fact that you were a Methodist, and brought up as a Methodist, basically. How important was the church in your early days? Did you join, for example, with the Boy Scouts or Church Light Brigade, anything like that?
I'll say chapel because, you know, the chapel was a bit irksome. I had to go three times on a Sunday, and on a Monday go to the Christian Endeavor, I think. And I didn't like it at all, and would not have done had I not been made to go. Was I a member? Yes, I became a member of the first West Rolston and his rank of acting cub masters. Before the arm, I went into the arm. I actually did meet Baden-Powell. And the circumstances which I think worth mentioning, in 1936, the Northern Counties Jamboree was held. There was Braby Castle. Yes, there was Braby Castle and Bransworth Castle here. It was the two centres that all the scouts of the Northern and Durham came to those to have a sort of jamboree. And the first West Standing troop was invited to come to Bransworth Castle. Well, why am I telling you all this? Because in 1936 I was in the army. Well, I was on the Louvre leave, a fortnight Louvre leave. And the first thing I did, of course, when I got home was got out of uniform, of course, relatively soon. And the friends, which for the majority were scouts, so I knew about this, different than told me. So I got back into my scouts uniform, came with the troop to Bransworth Castle, where all first class scouts were required to form a guard of honour from Baden-Powell. I being a first class scout, was in the guard of honour. Little would be knowing that I was a member of the regular army as well, but that's where I met Baden-Powell. I actually spoke to him as well.
So you must have been in the scouts quite a number of years.